Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Take a key part of the plan to control both air quality and global warming. Pass it through an industry in deep and serious trouble. Let a whole slew of politicians, both in Washington and at the state level, weigh in. And what you get are the new rules on auto emissions the president announced today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C., I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is great to have you with us on this Tuesday, the 19th of May. And I have to tell you, this has been a spectacular day in the nation's capital. Sunny, crisp, and cool, not a cloud in the sky. The kind of day that just makes you want to take a deep breath and smell the roses. Unfortunately, if you did that, as I did this morning not far from the White House, you'd have gotten a snoot full of car and truck exhaust from all the traffic going by. So really, it's no small irony that President Obama chose to be outdoors today in the Rose Garden for his big announcement on new mileage and emission standards. By 2016, new cars and light trucks will have to average 35.5 miles a gallon. That's up about 9 mpg from today's standard. And the news ends a bitter fight between car makers and states like California that have been trying to enforce their own tougher standards. And the president said it's going to give companies clear guidance for how to produce 21st century cars. Tamara Keith has more now on what those cars might be like.
In 2016, vehicles will probably look a lot like they do today. Charles Torito is with the Alliance for Automobile Manufacturers.
Some will be smaller and lighter. Some will be less powerful. Some may be more powerful.
There won't be a tectonic shift in the showroom, in part because fuel economy standards will vary depending on a vehicle's size.
For those who really do want a full-size Tahoe or Suburban, they will still be available. They won't necessarily be any smaller.
John DiCicco is at the Environmental Defense Fund. He says those mega SUVs will have more efficient engines, and they may be built with the kind of steel he recently saw at an industry symposium.
You would be amazed by the innovation in steel technology. I was picking up steel parts that were less than half of the old steel parts because they're using new advanced lightweight steels.
Experts say most of the technology needed to green the nation's vehicles is on the shelf now. Daniel Sperling directs the Institute of Transportation Studies at the University of California, Davis.
We'll see more diesel engines, we'll see more hybrid vehicles, and we'll just see better internal combustion engines, you know, better management of the valves, better transmissions.
And yes, cars will probably be more expensive. But depending on gas prices come 2016, drivers may just be willing to pay for efficiency. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
The legislation that will almost certainly impact your relationship with your credit card company passed the Senate today. It's already cleared the House, so the president could sign it by the end of the week. It would force credit card companies to go easy on borrowers who have trouble paying their bills. But those protections for troubled borrowers could mean bad news for people who pay their bills on time. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
The American Bankers Association says the legislation could send the credit card industry back 20 years when everyone paid an annual fee and even those with good credit paid a high interest rate on their debt. David Robertson publishes the credit card trade journal The Nilson Report. He says it's probably more like 30 years.
We're going to start seeing a drop in the number of credit cards in the United States, and we'll start seeing some different kinds of loyalties firm up.
Robertson says new fees of about $30 a year will push many consumers to regional financial institutions for credit cards, places that have many relationships with their customers, from mortgages to checking accounts.
They're making money from you in a variety of different ways, and therefore they don't have to get as fat, if you will, from you as a bank that's issuing a credit card to you, and that's the only relationship that they have with you.
Not everyone thinks today's Senate action will lead to fewer credit cards long term. Chris Ambruster is a research analyst at Al Frank, a fund that invests in credit card companies.
As consumers feel more comfortable using these credit cards, more comfortable with the fee structures, as they become more transparent, I think generally there will be a larger amount of money that is flowing through these credit cards.
Right now, most annual fee payers are at the high end and are rewarded with perks like airline miles. Ambruster says companies will likely offer those kinds of enticements as they fight for consumers. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The football season is still months away, but the country's most popular sports league is burying the hatchet with the nation's biggest cable company. The NFL Network and Comcast announced a settlement today that will ensure millions of fans will be able to watch the network this fall, as Joel Rose reports.
Comcast complained that the NFL was charging too much for its network, while the NFL sued Comcast for refusing to carry the channel on its regular cable package. It's been a contentious subject for years, but on today's conference call with reporters, Comcast CEO Brian Roberts and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell sounded like old friends. Here's Goodell.
He needed it for his customers. We need it for our fans. We can work together in a much more productive fashion than fighting.
In the end, Comcast agreed not to charge its subscribers a special premium for the NFL Network. The exact terms were not announced, but it appears that the NFL agreed to cut the price it charges Comcast. Smith College economics professor Andrew Zimbalist says in return, the NFL gets 8 million potential viewers.
They get much more exposure that helps them not only for the games when they're broadcast, but helps the promotion of the NFL Network in general.
The two sides also agreed to drop legal actions. Goodell says the NFL now hopes to negotiate with other cable operators, including Time Warner. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not really a full contact sport at all, more like a nice leisurely walk in the park. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The culprit so far in the meltdown of the banking industry has been real estate prices, residential real estate specifically, and the misguided belief that house prices would just keep on going up. That, it turns out, was not the only misguided belief that banks had. Analysts say a coming wave of losses from commercial real estate loans gone bad could tip yet more banks over the edge. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The credit crisis began when homeowners couldn't pay their mortgages. But as the pain has spread, more owners of shopping malls, hotels, and office buildings are defaulting on their loans. One of the casualties was Great Basin Bank in Elko, Nevada. The FDIC took over the bank last month after it suffered losses from commercial mortgages and construction loans. Janice Collette was a customer.
It takes us at least 3 or 4 hours to get to a major city such as Salt Lake, Reno, or Boise. So we're kind of isolated.
Fortunately, another bank bought Great Basin's assets, but it's a subsidiary of a Utah corporation. Collette says she'd prefer to do business with an Elko-based firm.
Because I like the idea of a local bank that loans to local people and keeps things kind of in the area.
Analysts expect to see more stories like this as the commercial real estate market deteriorates. Matthew Anderson studies the health of banks at Foresight Analytics. He says just over 3% of commercial mortgages were delinquent in the first 3 months of the year, and it's getting worse.
So not scary levels from historical comparison to the early 90s when delinquency rates were in the 9 to 10% range, but I think we're still pretty early on in this cycle.
As delinquencies rise, Anderson predicts at least another 100 banks will fail by the end of this year. Small banks are especially vulnerable. They don't have the diverse range of products that cushion larger banks as loans go bad. Richard Beauvais follows the market as an analyst at Rockdale Securities. He says thanks to market pressures and consolidation, small banks were disappearing well before this recession.
Every week since 1985, there have been 6 banks in the United States that have closed down or been merged out of existence.
That means we've lost more than 7,000 institutions in those 20-plus years. As larger banks take over, critics say they're less likely to invest in local businesses and community development. But Beauvais says customers may ultimately get a better deal. He says larger banks tend to charge lower fees and pay higher interest on accounts. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We sit down to chat with Dan Ariely about once a month or so. He's a behavioral economist at Duke University. And when he's not teaching, Dan is thinking about how humans and markets and entire economies sometimes do things that just don't make much sense. And then he tries to explain why. About a year ago, he wrote a book about that called Predictably Irrational. And since then, we have collectively given him so much more to talk about in terms of not making much sense that there is an expanded version of his book out this week. Dan, it's great to have you back.
Same here, as always.
So it's been a little bit more than a year since the first version of this book came out, and it's been quite the tumultuous year in the economy, obviously. Do you find that behavioral economics is a little bit more, I don't know, respectable now?
Oh, yeah, very much so. This has been a great year for me.
well, that's good, Dan.
Yeah, if you're looking for a sunlight in this whole thing, it's a behavioral economist. I mean, we are all celebrating. And the real issue is that, you know, for a long time, we would do these experiments showing all kinds of irrationalities, and people would say, okay, you know, it's very cute, it's very entertaining, it's amusing, but surely when it will come to people making large decisions in a repeated way who are experts, all of these irrationalities will go away and people would behave perfectly rational. In 2008, Greenspan's testimony that basically kind of you can summarize as, oops, you know, I thought the markets were rational, would take care of themselves, but they don't. I think there's a new realization of how important an endemic irrationality is, and that we really need to understand it better if we ever want to get out of not just this crisis, but we want to prevent the next ones who are just waiting around the corner.
It occurs to me that behavioral economics is pretty easy to figure out in hindsight, right? We can look back over the past year and a half since this your original book came out and say, well, look at the irrationalities. I mean, the mortgage market and so many smart people on Wall Street doing so many dumb things. Let me put the test to you then and ask you what we might see in the next year in terms of irrational economic behavior. Is there a way to figure that out?
So if you think about the problem from behavioral economics perspective, then what you would say is the following. We might get over the housing problem. We might help people. We might bail out some of the banks. But the real problem, the thing that was causing this whole issue, is actually the conflict of interest that the bankers had. And unless you solve that deeper problem, you haven't solved anything. So in fact, what we're doing is we're looking at the causes for these behaviors. And this actually helps you to think very much about regulation. So we can say, what are people naturally good at? And in those cases, all we need to do is to government to step out of our business and let us do whatever we can because we would optimize versus what kind of things do people fail in and fail in them routinely in predictable and repeatable ways. And those are the places that we would need to actually step in and regulate and don't let people create damage for themselves and for the economy.
When you go to a cocktail party and somebody says, so, Dan, lovely to meet you. What do you do for a living? What do you say?
I say, I examine human irrationality, and then what they say, oh, you must know my wife.
And then your wife says what?
And then I say, yes, I can see you saying it, but of course your wife is not next to you.
That's
when
right,
you
that's right.
Saying this. But you know, I think that there's actually a recent interest from the public in this irrationality, and there's a general mistrust, I think, in economics. I mean, think about what happened to us. We trusted economics to a very high degree. The metaphor of the market and freedom has permeated every aspect of society and of beliefs, and it's kind of driven us down to a very serious black hole. Even people that were schooled in rational economics but deal with the real world every day all of a sudden are looking at their own behavior and saying, I'm now recognizing all kinds of things I didn't see before. And, you know, that's kind of the first step for improvement.
Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. His book, revised and expanded, is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, not scanning at grocery stores, it's really just stealing.
And in our industry where the profit margins are very small, averaging about 1.5%, we want to make sure that we're collecting for everything that's going out the door.
But first, let's do the numbers. Really kind of blah on the street today. The Dow Industrial slid 29 points, a third of 1%, closed at 84.74. The NASDAQ added 2 points, a tenth of 1%, finished at 17.34. The S&P 500 dinked off 1 point, a tenth percent there, ended at 9.08. Bets that the tech sector would do okay offset a record low for housing starts. Investors pinned their hopes on Hewlett-Packard ahead of the tech bellwether's results. HP gained 2.5% today. IBM gained nearly 1% after its chief financial officer said the company expected margins to improve this year. Apple sweetened up 0.2%. Gold miner Newmont dug up 2.75% today. Tenet Healthcare gained 23%. The hospital chain reported better than estimated profits and also cut its cost. Those bad housing start numbers cost Home Depot. Filed off 5.75% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. American Public Media explores the economic crisis with 4 new documentaries supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing titled Oil and the Economy, the Impact of Rising Global Demand on the U.S. Recovery. The final round of the National Geographic Bee takes place. 10 kids compete for the honor of champion. Gotta be smart for that one. The contest will be televised. Also televised, the American Idol season finale. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Last week was Dream Week on the program, how the recession and the financial crisis are changing the traditional vision of the American dream of home ownership and a sound retirement and education as a way to get ahead. Sarah Gardner kicked off our series, The Next American Dream, by explaining that spending 4 or maybe 5 years as an undergrad doesn't set you up the way it used to.
Economists say a bachelor's degree is no longer the ticket to middle-class security that it once was.
Krishnan Chittoor wrote in to disagree, in part. Make that Professor Chittoor. He teaches engineering at the University of Alabama, Huntsville. And he says how much you get out of a bachelor's degree depends on which bachelor's degree you get.
There are still a few undergraduate degrees that are terminal where students do not have to get a master's. These include degrees in chemical, electrical, mechanical, and civil engineering. Over the years, I feel universities have cheapened the undergraduate degree, but at least in engineering, we're holding the line in these 4 disciplines.
And holding the line pretty well for a recession, too. Chittoor says one of his recent graduates has a new job bringing home $60,000 a year. We heard from commentator Kay Heimowitz, too. She recommends majoring in design, the economic engine of the future, she calls it. That message made Arlene White's job a little bit easier. She's the communications director at the Art Institute in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
I have passed this on to our admissions and career services personnel. It might help them when explaining to a parent, yes, your child really can make a living in a creative profession.
We also suggested that a key part of the next American dream might be renting. Dan Potter from San Jose, California, was a renter until he bought a condo 2 years ago. Now he's $135,000 underwater on a place that he paid $300,000 for. But the problem isn't just money.
It's that I'm tied to my house. If I want to change jobs, I can't go any further than I'm willing to commute. If I decide to get married and have children, we won't be able to move into a bigger place. If freedom is something Americans care about, then the American dream looks a lot like renting.
Last week was the beginning of the end for almost 2,000 Chrysler and General Motors dealerships, including Dan Amaral's family business, Amaral Motors in Newtown, Connecticut. Amy Scott brought us his story on Friday afternoon. Over the weekend, we heard from Alan Hubbard. He's the parts and services director at the competition, Bruce Bennett Nissan, in nearby Wilton, Connecticut. He wrote to give Dan and the other dealers who are going to be closing their doors a tip of the hat.
He is
representative of hundreds of other entrepreneurial dealers who have been the backbone of American small towns. And this is the end of an era.
Share your thoughts with us. Comments, observations, or corrections. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. If you subscribe to the oil prices as economic indicator school of thought, traders in New York had good news for you today. Crude closed above $59 a barrel this afternoon, a sign, perhaps, that the recession has given us its worst. Or perhaps those traders have it completely wrong, because there are huge crude surpluses sloshing around out there, and they could keep prices under pressure for some time to come, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The offices of Lloyd's List, the oldest shipping journal in the world. Energy editor Martin Wingrove peers into his computer screen. He's tracking the movement of large oil tankers around the globe.
This one is now moored off Malta. There you go. That looks like it's going to have 2 million barrels of very large crude carrier.
He says don't be fooled by the rising price of oil or the recent dip in US inventories. The world is awash with crude.
There is plenty of supply, and all the onshore storage is filling up and is likely to be full in the very near future.
Within a couple of weeks, according to Goldman Sachs, the bank reckons that every major onshore oil storage facility will be full by June. Simon Wardell of Global Insight says the world has never had more oil in reserve.
It's 2.9 billion barrels at the moment, which is about as high as it's ever been, certainly in terms of absolute numbers.
Oil producers have cut their output, but demand has fallen even more. And faced with a growing reservoir of unwanted crude, with onshore storage tanks bursting at the seams, oil companies have taken their product offshore. They're storing it at sea. Axel Busch is with the Energy Intelligence Group.
Oil companies and traders are taking their barrels and stuffing them into very large crude oil carriers, tankers, which then sit in strategic places around the world.
52 supertankers are now loitering at sea in places like the Gulf of Mexico. They carry 130 million barrels of oil. They're sitting out the recession, waiting for the global economy to recover, for the price of oil to take off again. They could have quite a wait, says Simon Wardell. Speculators have been piling into the oil futures market and buoying up prices, but that's no substitute for real demand.
So you can't support these price moves just with financial and investment class movements in the markets. You need real fundamental support to see it. And we're not seeing that at the moment, so we're concerned that prices are going to sink quite sharply.
Leo Drolos of the Center for Global Energy Studies says that the world's ever-growing stockpiles of oil are a boon. They'll put a brake on future price rises.
There's so much oil stored that when demand recovers, it doesn't mean that the price shoots up, because a lot of this oil will come out from storage, which prevents the price from soaring.
And choking off the economic recovery.
And choking off the recovery.
In spite of stock market optimism, that recovery still seems a long way off. The International Energy Agency has just forecast a further drop in oil demand this year. Oil stocks seem set to grow even bigger. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
When you go to the grocery store, what do you do while the clerk is scanning whatever's in your cart? I don't really expect you to know, but chances are you're perusing the tabloids or telling the kids no, they can't have any candy. Something benign, in other words. But that doesn't mean somebody's not watching you, because just as supermarkets installed those barcode scanners years ago to speed things up and be more efficient, now they are turning to high tech once again to catch the stuff that doesn't get scanned. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains.
Many of us have had this experience. You go to the market, get to the cashier with a cart full of stuff.
It's $115.82.
Head out the door looking at your receipt, and you realize you didn't pay for that bag of Doritos. Cashiers miss things like that all the time. Sometimes it's intentional. Losses at the checkout counter add up to about $13 billion a year for U.S. stores. Most groceries have cameras that track cashiers. But who's going to watch all that video?
It's just impossible from a labor point of view. And they'd still miss things.
Mark Gaudet tracks theft for Big Y, a chain of 58 grocery stores in New England.
Instead of employing legions of video-watching security guards, he uses a software system called StopLift. The program monitors body motion in the videos and syncs it with the cash register. Gaudette says it catches unpaid items most of the time and then alerts store managers with the footage.
Notice that she lifted that package of meat up and over the scanner so that it wouldn't scan.
Gaudette says sometimes cashiers are distracted. Other times, they're giving things away to family or friends. Either way, it's a loss to the store.
Everybody in the retail world's trying to save every dollar. And in our industry, where the profit margins are very small, averaging about 1.5%, we want to make sure that we're collecting for everything that's going out the door.
Big Y is the first chain in the country to adopt the StopLift system. Safeway and others have installed it at some stores. Malloy Kandu developed the software. He says he's had a lot of inquiries lately.
And I think that's directly tied to the downturn.
Kandu sells the software on a subscription basis. It can cost a mid-sized store about $2,000 a month. Before StopLift, Kandu studied advanced video technology at Harvard and MIT.
I used to develop real-time facial recognition systems for airport security.
Similar surveillance systems are also being tested to look for potential terrorists or abandoned packages in large crowds. Some cities have bought the systems to watch tourist destinations. Food marketing expert Phil Lempert says this new security could actually pose a problem for stores by being too intrusive.
How can we make sure that it's just the cashier that's being watched and not the customer? And will we have consumers who won't shop at those stores just because of those surveillance cameras?
It could also be tough for a chain like Big Y to attract staff. Gaudette says they've fired a handful of checkers who weren't scanning everything. He says for the most part, he uses the system to train employees. Anne-Marie Perez oversees the registers at a store in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Everybody seems to be paying a little bit more attention, it seems. I'm being a little more cautious myself, too, you know?
And maybe that's all grocery stores are looking for. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today along the lines of, wow, did you really mean to say that? JPMorgan Chase had its annual shareholder meeting today, at which CEO Jamie Dimon was greeted as a conquering hero. And yes, his company did pretty well last year, but it did sort of sound like gloating when he called 2008 the bank's, quote, best year ever. This was, remember, when Dimon snapped up both Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual as they teetered right on the brink of bankruptcy. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 29 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq added 2 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 dropped 1 point, a tenth of 1% there as well. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Thanks also today to the staff here at WAMU. Coming up next time on the broadcast, back home in Los Angeles, running a big box retailer in a recession.
Clearly, this is the most challenging consumer environment in the last 50 years. So consumers are just more stressed as it relates to their economic situation. And so they're focused more on buying things they need and not what they want.
Another conversation from the corner office, this time with Target's CEO, or Target if you prefer. We asked him about that, too. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.